This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg. Now, gamma ray bursts are the most powerful explosions in the universe, releasing as much energy in seconds as our sun actually emits over its entire lifetime. Scientists have long believed that magnetic fields power these events, but actually measuring them has remained one of astrophysics' toughest challenges. That is, until now. My guest today is Dr. Tanmoy Lasker, assistant professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah, who studies gamma ray bursts and other energetic cosmic explosions. Using the National Science Foundation's Very Large Array, Dr. Lasker and a team from the University of Arizona and the University of Utah have pointed their telescope at an unusually close, unusually bright burst. What they found was a first: polarized radio light twisting across wavelengths in a pattern called Faraday rotation, never before detected in a gamma ray burst. Now, what does this all mean? Let's find out. Dr. Tanmoy Lasker, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Scott, thank you for having me. Looking forward to this conversation.
Me too, because first of all, explosions in space, that just kind of sounds cool. And we'll get to what that actually really means. But let's really start off kind of on the basic level here. For listeners who really aren't familiar, what exactly is a gamma ray burst, and why do astronomers consider them the most powerful explosions in the universe?
Yeah, the sky as we know it is changing, and it's changing on very fast times, on the times of seconds and minutes and hours. So when we go out and we look at the night sky, we sometimes see the same stars every night, from night to night. The sun might change position, the planets change position. Sometimes you have a comet that might come by, but those things are on maybe a few days or months or years. But when astronomers use telescopes that are not just our eyes, but use more powerful telescopes, we find things in the sky changing at fast timescales, things that are burbling or exploding or appearing and disappearing. And gamma ray bursts are just one of those type of cosmic phenomenon. As you mentioned, these are the most powerful explosions. And so among all of the different types of explosions we've found so far, and we keep finding new ones, these are perhaps the most energetic and the furthest exploding things that we can see or that we found so far.
Well, what is, by the way, a very large array?
That's astronomers being very creative with the names of the facilities that we use. So the Very Large Array is a radio telescope that is in New Mexico in the United States. And it is an array of 27 dishes. So think satellite antennas, but much, much larger. They sit on rails and they move around on the ground every few months. They are connected together with optical fibers, and that information is fed together into a giant computer and is used to make radio maps of the sky.
So this array is really a series of satellite dishes that you can manipulate or move?
That's exactly right. So when I say satellite dishes, yes, they are radio dishes. And in terms of us manipulating, I would love to be able to move them myself, but they are such powerful instruments. They are precision facilities. So for that reason, we are not allowed to touch them. There are operators who run the telescope. It's run by the National Science Foundation. It's a National Science Foundation instrument, a facility. And what we do as scientists is we put in a request to say, if an event like this happens, we would like to train this telescope on this event, please. And then some of our peers get together and they look at our what we call telescope proposals, and they decide if that sounds exciting enough. And if it does, then we get some time on the telescope. And then when something goes off, we get a text alert on our cell phones and we ask the telescope to please have a look at this object for us. And then we look at the data.
So evidently something went off on your cell phone, because there's something called, and I might get this wrong, but it's GRB260310A. Why was that special? First of all, I want to know what it is, but then why is it special enough to reveal something that's never been detected before in a gamma ray burst? And I assume that GRB stands for gamma ray burst?
That is the first part of the mystery, yes, indeed. GRB just stands for gamma ray burst. It is, astronomers love our TLAs, our three-letter acronyms, or in this case, just an abbreviation. And it's the rest of the sequence of digits actually stands for the month, year, and the year, month, and day on which that event was discovered. So it was discovered in 2026 on the 3rd of March and the 10th of, in the month of March and then the 10th day of March. And the letter A just means that it is the first such event discovered that day. Believe it or not, there can be, and there often are, multiple bursts discovered on the same day. And then they get subsequent letters starting A, B, C, and so forth. So 260310A was a very bright gamma ray burst. These are, I would say, maybe 100 or so are found every year. So they are discovered pretty frequently. Don't let that suggest to you that it is a very common event. They happen maybe once every tens or hundreds of thousands of years, or maybe a million years in any given galaxy. But because they are so incredibly bright, we can see them out to the edge of the visible universe, which means we see them all across the universe. And when we say we see 100 of them a year, these are spread all over the universe. So they are actually pretty rare intrinsically.
So the Earth is spinning, the universe is spinning, our galaxy is spinning, everything is spinning.
It is.
How do you, first of all, even detect this? And then how do you actually pinpoint its location with all this rotation going on?
That's a fantastic question. Let's go back to a bit of history. So when we say gamma ray burst, that's exactly what it sounds like. It's a burst of gamma rays or a flash of gamma rays. And gamma rays, of course, are just another type of light. So visible light that we use to look at the universe is or at our cell phones at night or on the subway or the radiation that the sun makes. That's visible light. Then there's, of course, radio waves, which the very large array operates in. Infrared light, which is used in sensors, indoor sensors, ultraviolet light, X-rays, which we use for when we fall off the swing and we have to get an X-ray, that's also light. And then there's gamma rays. And so gamma rays are the most intense, most energetic form of light. So these are flashes of gamma rays that come from space. So it's very energetic, short flashes, maybe a few seconds, that come from space. These were originally discovered in the 1960s and 70s by US military satellites called the Bela satellites. And they were these satellites were sent up to enforce nuclear treaties to ensure that there were no tests of nuclear weapons in the Earth's atmosphere or in space. And these satellites were aiming to look for flashes of gamma rays from nuclear weapon testing. And they found flashes of gamma rays, but they were not coming from the Earth. And thankfully, people realized that they were not coming from the Earth because otherwise it would have had disastrous consequences. Why do you need satellites? It's because gamma rays cannot go through the Earth's atmosphere. And good thing too, because gamma rays are quite damaging radiation, just like hard ultraviolet and X-ray radiation. So we are saved, for instance, from all of the sun's gamma. The sun makes a lot of gamma rays, but we are saved from all of that by the atmosphere. So the flip side to this is that we didn't really know what the sky looked like in gamma rays. We didn't know that the universe made these very energetic flashes of gamma rays until we started sending satellites up. So the Vela satellites found these flashes of gamma rays, and then there were dedicated gamma ray instruments in the subsequent decades that went up to see what are these things. And they found that indeed there are these flashes of gamma rays. They are not coming from the sun. They're not coming from other planets. They're not even coming from our own galaxy. They're coming from distant galaxies across the universe. And so that meant that they were extremely powerful flashes to be seen at these huge distances. And we have a better sense now where we think these come from, but they're essentially flashes of gamma rays from exploding stars or dying stars and at great distances in other galaxies.
Okay, so if this happens, I wouldn't say infrequently, maybe you said 100 times a year we're seeing these flashes. What was so unique about this particular burst?
Yeah, so we, because these bursts are happening every so often, one of the things we are wondering is what makes these flashes? We still don't know what actually makes these flashes. We have a couple of ideas. We think that when a star, a very massive star, maybe 20 times the mass of our sun, dies, it runs out of fuel, collapses, and dies, it produces a black hole at its center as it collapses. And that black hole, as it is feeding on the entrails of the star, as it is collapsing onto itself, emits this beam of particles for a short duration. And as that beam of particles punches out of the star, it emits this flash of gamma rays. So that's one theory. We think that that's definitely one of the ways that this happens. Another way it can happen is if two very old dead stars called neutron stars, which are basically the dead cores of the cores of long dead stars that have just been haunting the universe, find each other and merge, they can produce also a black hole and this jet of light, of particles, and then the jet produces light. So to finish the answer to your previous question, I guess I didn't answer this part. How do we find them? So the Vela satellites are long gone, but now we have the next generation space telescopes that are basically scanning the sky, looking for these flashes of gamma rays. And how do we pinpoint them? The satellites have some ability to get us a rough location of where the flash came from. And then we point ground-based telescopes, telescopes on the ground, visible light telescopes, radio telescopes, to look in the same general area and look for a new star, a new event, a new point, a source of light that wasn't there before. And that's called the afterglow. So what is special about this one? It was very nearby. And we like nearby things, not too nearby, because that would be really scary. And thankfully, that's not happened yet. But there is a theory that the dinosaurs were wiped out by a gamma ray burst. But we can talk about that another time. So this one was nearby, of course, yet in a distant galaxy. And when things are nearby, they are exciting for astronomers because they allow us to look at these events in great detail. We can study them in much more detail than we could a distant event. And we're still trying to understand what makes these. What is this type of star that explodes? These are so energetic. How is so much energy packed into such a small amount of time, like the entire sun's lifetime's worth of energy in a few seconds? That's incredible conditions. We can't reproduce that on Earth. So we want to understand, are the laws of physics different when we have so much energy in such a small amount of time being released? Or how does physics operate? So it's basically also like a laboratory for us to study physics at these very extreme conditions of density and temperature, and as we'll talk about in a second, magnetic fields that we just can't get in Earth-bound experiments. So this was special because it was nearby, it is very bright, and that allowed us to study it in a lot of detail.
But why is this different? I mean, you see gamma ray bursts. I guess there was something that I mentioned in the opening remarks about a Faraday effect.
Yeah, that's right.
And why does it matter?
Yeah, so the question is, once we looked at it, what did we find? And so in this particular case, we made a discovery that has never been done before. And we found magnetic fingerprints all over the radio light from this exploding star. Let me talk a little bit about the polarization of light, which will be relevant for our conversation. So often when we are thinking about light, we just talked about the energy of light. We talked about X-ray light and gamma ray light and visible light and infrared light. So light, the color of light is one of its properties. The direction in which the light is traveling is another of its properties. And the third property that we don't often talk about in our day-to-day life, but is also important, and we do use this in devices in day-to-day life, is called its polarization. So light has two forms of polarization. It can either be wiggling up and down or sideways as the light is moving toward us. And what is wiggling is the electric field inside the light. So as light is coming toward us, either the electric field is wiggling left and right or it's wiggling up and down. That's the basic idea. And this concept of polarization is exploited in devices across our daily life. So an example of it is polarized sunglasses, which I actually have right here. And these are, we use these in our daily life when we are attempting to avoid glare of like surfaces of a car hood or a lake surface if we are out doing water sports, or the glare from the snow when people are skiing, which is a favorite sport to do here in Utah. So what is happening there is that the light is reflecting, and the light from the sun is unpolarized, which means that it has equal amounts of wiggling in left and right and up and down. But when it reflects off, one of the polarizations of light gets reflected more than the other. So the light that we're seeing is preferentially polarized in one direction because it has more wiggling in one direction. So our polarized sunglasses are designed to cut out that polarization, and that reduces the glare. So we also see polarized light being used, for instance, in 3D glasses in cinemas. And so it's a common thing, even though we may not think about it. So what we found, the first thing we found about this gamma ray burst was that the radio light that we saw from it. So we turned the very large array that we were talking about to look at the afterglow, the radiation from this event in radio waves. And we found that the radio waves were polarized. So just like our sunglasses, they had been through some medium that removed only one, that removed a portion of their polarization, or they were being produced in preferentially polarized along one direction. That is the first discovery that we made, which it's been seen before in visible light. It's also been seen at microwave light, which is radiation that our microwaves use, but it had never been seen before with at these low frequency radio wavelengths, these radio long radio wavelengths with a very large array. So that is the first discovery, and it was really cool. The other part that made it especially interesting was the fact that not only did we see it using one wavelength, but we had many different radio receivers at the very large array look at this event at different radio wavelengths. And we were able to study how polarized it was and in which direction the light was wiggling at different wavelengths as a function of the wavelength. And we found that the wiggling direction was changing as a function of wavelength. And this is called the Faraday effect. The Faraday effect has been seen in on the Earth, and it you find it everywhere in life. You find it in sugar solutions. You find it in anywhere you have a magnetic field, which is the Earth has a magnetic field. You have crystals. All of those exhibit this effect. It's basically the two different polarizations of light travel at different speeds, and that causes the direction of wiggling to be different from when it entered to when it leaves that medium. And so what we found here was that this light had gone through some dense medium with a strong magnetic field, and that had, as a function of wavelength, it had changed the direction that the light was wiggling. And the only way we could figure this out was because we had information at different wavelengths within the radio band, and we could see the wiggling was different at different wavelengths.
Well, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a fascinating conversation with Dr. Tanmoy Lasker, Assistant Professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah, who studies gamma ray bursts and other energetic cosmic explosions, and who should probably be writing a horror fiction because he's just described things such as a star eating the entrails of planets or dead stars haunting our universe. So it's very graphic description of what's going on out there. Getting back to this magnetic fingerprint that you're describing, the wiggling effect of the light waves or wavelengths coming through, and why this is so unique. What's been so difficult about detecting gamma ray bursts until now? I mean, this is, as you said, we've been picking this up since the 60s with these satellites. What's been so, after decades of study, what's been so difficult? Why are we getting around to it now?
That's such a fantastic question. As you said, we've known about these for several decades. The new thing we now have is fabulous instruments that can do this. So the Very Large Array, for instance, the instrument that the facility that we use to do this, make this discovery, has undergone a complete refurbishment in the 2010s, and has a completely new instrument, and it's finally able to do this. And the reason we couldn't do this before is because we could not study this, the polarization of the light, very well with the Very Large Array or these facilities. So think about it this way. The light that we are seeing is there's its intrinsic brightness, but there's also its polarization. And the light is not fully polarized. It's not fully wiggling in one direction, up or down. It's only fractionally polarized. So most of the time, on average, the light is wiggling up and down and left and right. But again, on average, there's a slight more wiggling in one direction than the other. Another direction. So it's partially polarized. And that slight amount is in this case about 3%. So it's a little more wiggling, about 3% more wiggly in one direction than another direction. And being able to determine that fraction or measure that very weak amount of polarization requires a very sensitive instrument. And that's not been possible to do before. So it either requires a very sensitive instrument or a very bright event, because it's a fractional effect. So in this case, we had a fantastic new instrument, the Very Large Array, and we had a very bright nearby event. And the other thing that made this possible in this case was, as I mentioned, the Faraday rotation requires us to study not just the direction of wiggling at one wavelength, but the direction as a function of wavelength. So we need to chunk our data up into little wavelength bins and ask how much is it, which direction is it wiggling at this higher, longer wavelength, and which direction is it wiggling at the shorter wavelength. And we chunking that data requires us to be able to get a what is called a bandwidth, a large bandwidth, the same concept that is used for DSL internet. Like it's a lot, there's more information you can transport if you have a large bandwidth. And the old VLA system about 20 years ago did not have that kind of bandwidth. But now we have huge, like several gigahertz worth of bandwidths. And in those amount of bandwidth, we can chunk our data up into little sections and study the light as a function of the wavelength. And that gives us a beautiful magnetic spectrum or magnetic fingerprint of the radiation.
Your findings point to a magnetic field thousands of times stronger than anything from our own galaxy or even intergalactic space. What does a field that strong tell us about the environment around the actual explosion that produced this?
Yeah, and this is a question that we are now scratching our heads over because we did not expect such a strong magnetic field. We think these magnetic fields, so what we were expecting was magnetic fields inside the region that's making the light. So a little bit of what I think is cool physics, what is happening is that there's some particles are being ejected in this little jet, or it's a huge jet, but very energetic jet, and the jet is making light. And we thought that we'd be seeing magnetic fields inside the jet, but actually we are seeing magnetic fields not inside the jet, but quite a large distance outside, we think, because we don't think the magnetic fields are that strong inside the jet in this case. So this star that is dying and is producing this jet is cocooned inside a region that has a huge magnetic field. So we think that what is happening is we are seeing the signature of the birthplace of the star. So these are very young stars, or rather, they're short-lived stars, let's say, because these are very massive stars. The more massive a star is, the shorter its lifetime before it explodes. And so this star probably didn't live very long. And for an astronomical point of view, very long is maybe at a million years, as opposed to the sun's life, which is maybe to 10 billion years. So this star probably lived about a million years, didn't get very far from where it started. And we think it's enshrouded in its original birth cloud. And inside that birth cloud, there's dense gas and there's this magnetic field that is putting its imprint upon the light as it traverses from the star to us. So we've just unlocked a new mechanism of studying magnetic fields inside the birth clouds of massive stars.
I love the University of Utah. It is such an innovative place, but this was a collaboration between the University of Arizona and the University of Utah. How did the team's different areas of expertise come together on this project?
So I have a fantastic collaborator at the University of Arizona, and the two of us work together. So this is a PhD student at the University of Arizona. So I wrote the University of Utah, we wrote the telescope proposal, we collected the observations, and our team at the University of, our collaborators at the University of Arizona did the data analysis and they made the discovery of polarized light. So they had the technical skills that we were developing together for another project. And it just so happened that this event occurred while we were building up or upskilling for this new project, the new collaborative project. As we took the data and our collaborators at Arizona looked at the data, they said, well, this is very exciting. We've been looking at mostly noise for the last several months in our other project. And look, here we have this bright, strong signal in our data. So what do we think this is? And then we had a fantastic back and forth to understand the observations and write our publication in just a few short days.
That's amazing. So what's the next step for your research now that this door's been opened? And what are the questions you're hoping that you can get answered? What are you most excited about right now?
Yeah. So this, as I mentioned, unlocks a new window, and I'm looking forward to drawing the curtains a bit further apart. So for instance, in this particular event, all the conversations we've had just now is based on observations we took just about a few hours, a day or so after the event. So we have one set of observations that we talked about that we published, but we have 10 times as much data where we've looked at the event again and again and again at multiple times as the event is fading, and we have the same magnetic fingerprint, but maybe it's changing. We don't know. So I have a new postdoctoral researcher in my group who's looking at the data to see, is the fingerprint changing? Do we have any signals from within the jet itself? Or is the fingerprint static? Is the polarization of the light itself? So this is a bit like we've studied the external effect on the light, but we also want to study the light itself, the intrinsic polarization of the light. Is what is that doing? What does that tell us about the jets? What are the jets made of? And can the polarization of the light tell us something about that? And that's the direction that our research is going to take soon.
Well, Dr. Tanmoy Lasker, assistant professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah, who studies gamma ray bursts and cosmic explosions. Just can't get over that. I like saying cosmic explosions. Thank you so much for being our guest today on Cool Science Radio. It's been a pleasure and enlightening.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been wonderful to talk to you, Scott.